Can everyone hear me? All right, so I just want to thank everyone for joining us today. The Alumni Lecture Series is a series we started to allow alumni and friends to have access to the university's most engaging professors and their profound insights and expertise. The series itself has become one of our most popular lifelong learning programs offered by the Alumni Office. If you have an idea or topic you'd like us to cover, please feel free to reach out to us and suggest. Support for this program happens through our charitable giving opportunities. This week, Yeshiva University is participating in Giving Tuesday. It's a national day to create a giving kickoff. Similar to retail stores and Black Friday, nonprofits and universities are coming together to launch a day dedicated to giving. So we have these postcards. This year's theme is, this Hanukkah, give the gift of scholarship. So Giving Tuesday is happening this Tuesday, so we hope you can participate. Also making this event happen is our host, Mr. Jay Schachter, who we thank dearly for his sponsorship and organizing. Mr. Jay Schachter is Managing Director of SP Capital IQ, where he's responsible for developing multi-vertical product adaptation, as well as evaluating long-term corporate strategies. Mr. Schachter received a BA from Yeshiva University in 1984 and an MA in 1988. He has a JD and a Master's of Philosophy from Columbia University. Jay and Deborah Schachter are sponsoring a Dead Sea Scrolls seminar at YU, which is in its second year, and that program is being coordinated by our speaker, Dr. Lawrence Schiffman, and with Dr. Moshe Bernstein. A conference is being planned for this spring to make sure that you are on our email list to receive more. Here to introduce our speaker is Mr. Jay Schachter.
Thank you, everybody, and I'll be brief because I know we have a very exciting, entertaining lecture coming up soon. Back in the 80s, when I attended Yeshiva College, we had the privilege of hosting the president of Standard & Poor's, Ira Herenstein, to address the student body. Now, 25 years later, I appreciate the fact that we could return in kind. So I'm currently as a managing director of Standard & Poor's, a division of McGraw-Hill Companies. We are delighted to host Professor Schiffman here to discuss the Dead Sea Scrolls on Hanukkah. Very, very briefly, Dr. Schiffman is Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education and Professor of Judaic Studies at Yeshiva University. He taught for 39 years at NYU, where he was the Edelman Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies and Chair of the Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies. He has written and edited dozens of published books and over 200 articles on the Dead Sea Scrolls and Rabbinic Judaism. Professor Schiffman's endeavors in the Dead Sea Scrolls need no introduction. I do want to mention that I was privy last week to have a conversation with Professor Lewis Feldman, who co-authored with Professor Schiffman his newest book that I think is coming out tomorrow. And perhaps maybe Professor Schiffman could discuss that book as well after his lecture. Please greet Professor Schiffman.
Thank you. So Jay began with thanks, and without taking too long, I want to thank him again for his support of our Dead Sea Scrolls seminar. We do hold also, as part of it, a public event once in a while, and we're actually going to be holding a very nice event soon to honor the fact that two volumes of collected studies were published by Professor Moshe Bernstein, whom you should hear down here sometime, and anyhow, who works with me on that seminar and who has been teaching Dead Sea Scrolls at YU for many years as a great Dead Sea Scrolls colleague. And I just wanted to note in this context that our seminar is getting bigger and bigger because so many people are interested in it, and it, I think, is a very good sign of what you can do with the right contribution in the right place and really do something wonderful with it. So we really appreciate what Jay and his wife are doing. I'll just briefly mention the fact that there is this new three-volume thing called Outside the Bible. If you just go to the website of the Jewish Publication Society or the University of Nebraska, which are doing it together, you can see what it is. It's three volumes of Second Temple literature: Scrolls, Philo, Josephus, Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, and with a commentary which aims to place it in the context of the history of Judaism. It's not cheap, but it's a very worthwhile thing. And we worked on it for a long time, and very happy to see it come out. So let's get to our topic of today. I hope everybody has a handout. Now, to understand this topic, you have to know, first of all, that the end of the Hanukkah story that you're used to when you read some newspaper or you hear it told by your rabbi is not the real end. You see, it's true that in 164 BCE, after fighting against the Seleucids, the Maccabees recovered Jerusalem and cleansed the Beis HaMikdash. This is true. But it's also true that soon after, due to some various political intriguing, a Kohen named Alkimus, known as Yakim in the Gemara, was installed in Jerusalem, and the Maccabees were somehow thrown out. Exactly how this happened is not clear from all of our sources, but they were thrown out. And this led to a situation in which Judah and his brothers were fighting once again against the Seleucid Syrians in the Judean countryside. In the year 160, Yehuda himself was killed in this fighting, and the Hasmonean Empire, as we call it, the rule of the Maccabees, did not actually start until 152 BCE. And this is under Yonatan, who was the third brother after Elazar had been killed also in fighting. He's the one who was killed, crushed under an elephant. Some of you may remember in the old Birnbaum Siddurim, they had this medieval text called Megillat Antiochus. And one of the things in there was they told that story. Unfortunately, there's not in our Siddurim anymore. No one will have that text to read anymore. But in any case, unless you're an Italian Jew, because they actually read it on Hanukkah. But in any case, that's a medieval text which had some traditions from the books of the Maccabees. So in any case, in 152, what we call the Hasmonean Empire was established with Jonathan, as the first real ruler. He was called an ethnarch. He was the high priest, recognized by the people. Now, how did he get into office? He got into office because of the fact that there was a competition going on in Syria at that time between two rulers contending for the right to be the rulers of Seleucid Syria, which is the people who are the Greeks of the Maccabean story, right? It's not real Greeks. It's the Syrian continuators of the tradition of Alexander the Great. That's who the Yevanim, Yevanim Nikbutsu Alai in Maosor, they're not Yevanim like people from Greece. They're Hellenized Syrians who were among those who continued the tradition after the empire of Alexander the Great was divided up in 311 BCE. So in any case, these Seleucid Greeks, right, were Greek Hellenized Seleucids, were competing for who would be the ruler. And Yonatan had 10,000 soldiers in the hills of Judea. So he said to the weakest one, I'll side with you, because he was smart and he knew better to side with a weak one than a strong one. And in return, the Seleucids, who had fought the Jews and the Maccabees for so long, installed him or approved of his becoming ruler in Jerusalem. And that's the beginning of the dynasty of the Hashmonaim that lasts until 63 BCE. Now, that is the thing that triggered the founding of the Dead Sea sect. Now, here I'm going to tell you this is my theory. Not everyone agrees, but I admit it's my theory. So here's what happened. When Yonatan came back to Yerushalayim, in a certain sense, he had to do the whole same deal over again. He had to take the city. He had to install a proper government. He had to install proper Kohanim and have the Beis HaMikdash run in the right way. And he blamed the Tzdukim, the Sadducees, who were the high priestly sect, for all of the extreme Hellenization that had gone on, including the bringing of an actual idol into the temple. So what he did was to make common cause with the Pharisees, the Prushim, and to install Kohanim who would follow the rulings of the Prushim, the forerunners of the rabbis, in the Beis HaMikdash. This caused a crisis among the Kohanim, among the priests. And a small group of Kohanim, who call themselves B'nai Tzadok, descendants of Tzadok, which is the same word as Sadducee, Tzdukim, right? Tzadok was one of the two high priests of Shlomo. These priests went out and they said, we don't accept what you're doing, and they founded a sect in protest. Because they thought that what was going on from the time of Yonatan in 152 BCE was a basic violation of the laws of sacrifice and the laws of purity and impurity, and they formed this group. Now, at that time, they actually went and set up, now I'm going to need one of your handouts because you have the numbers, thank you. I realized the handout, I brought out no numbers. Okay. They went out and they set up a sectarian group for the purpose of following their own legal rulings. Now, if you take a look at your handout, you'll notice that we have some evidence for the chronology of this event in number one. Because number one is from a document that had been found in the Cairo Geniza, the collection of manuscripts from the medieval period, which later was found in 10 copies at Qumran. It's called the Damascus document. Most Dead Sea Scrolls have more than one name. It's also called the Sadducite Fragments. And it says there, in the period of wrath, 390 years after he, God, had handed the temple over to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylonia, he remembered them, Israel, and caused to grow from Israel and Aaron the root of a plant. This means the Dead Sea sect, which is often described as if it is a plant growing. Now, if you take 390 years after Nebuchadnezzar, so if you take the historical date that historians use of 586, so you're going to come back up to 196. And then the text goes on, and it says that they knew something was wrong. You can take a look at text 2 quickly, but it says that they were like blind men groping on the road for 20 years until the teacher of righteousness arose, Moreh HaTzedek, who is the leader of the sect. Now, what this means is that if you follow this chronology, starting with our historical understanding of when the date of the Churban was, of the destruction of the temple, you would get down to a date of about 196, and then you'd have 20 years groping around, and you'd have the sect coming around in 176. But I just told you that it happened in 152 or so, 150, 105, something like that. So what am I talking about? So you have to understand, we can't take the number too literally. The reason we can't take it literally is because, you know, there's a dispute between the traditional Jewish date for the destruction of the temple and the date which is given in by modern historians. The reason why that dispute exists is because, actually, people didn't know exactly when it happened. We have sources of information they didn't used to have, but they didn't exactly know. So I figure that we can take this approximately and just figure that the person is describing the rise of this sectarian group in something around 150 and not worry about the difference. But you see, the text here does actually give what might be understood as an earlier date. What's key to me is the 20 years of groping. The teacher didn't start the group. The group gets started, and then at some point it's leaderless, and the teacher of righteousness, Moreh HaTzedek, arises to lead it. So now take a look at text 3. This is a document called MMT, Miktzat Maaseh HaTorah. You may remember that in 1991, on Christmas morning, the New York Times, because of the feeling that the scrolls were somehow connected to Christianity, editorialized about the fact that this document hadn't been published. This was symbolic of the problem of the publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but they're all published now. And anyhow, the document is a collection of laws. It starts out, these are some of our legal rulings regarding God's Torah, which are some of the rulings of the laws which we hold, and they are regarding sacrifices and purity, and then it breaks off. Now, the point I want to make to you is that this document was apparently sent by the founders of a sect to indicate the halachic Jewish law reasons for which they were forming this sectarian group. Now, after they list 20-something laws which they disagreed with about sacrifices and laws of purity, they then, right at the end, in section number 4, you know that we've separated from the mainstream of the people from all the impurities and from mixing in manners, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, and we're totally honest and we're totally upright. And then in 5, we have written to you in order that you will investigate. This basically means the whole Bible. And then finally, in 6, we read for you some of the rulings in the Torah which we consider were good for your people. We see that you have wisdom and knowledge of the Torah, right? So, by the way, knowledge of the Torah is Mada Torah, for those people who want to discuss the Yeshiva University slogan, Torah Mada. Understand all these matters and seek from him, from God, that you correct your counsel. What they're writing here is a prayer that the other guys in Yerushalayim, who are the Kohanim, should change their minds and follow their views. So what happens then is they enter the 20 years of groping. They tell them that, listen, we don't like what you're doing over here. They write some kind of a letter, which we have in 6 copies in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we don't know if it was really sent, by the way. It could be like a nasty letter that one of us writes and never sends, although with computers and email today, most people end up sending the nasty letters that they never would have sent otherwise, right? Okay, so what happens is they send some kind of a letter, apparently, and in it they say, we don't like what you're doing, and if you don't shape up, we're not going to return, but if you do, we think everything will be fine. Oh, the other guy, sorry, we're not interested in you. As a result of it, they form a sect. And then sometimes later, that's the 20 years groping, enough to take it literally, there comes forward the leader, the teacher of righteousness. So I want to make one point right now, which is that what this means is that the sect would have been formed by a group of religious, pious tzedukim who follow the rules of the tzedukim, which is why the document in question, the MMT document, Mitzvot Maaseh Torah, is loaded with laws in the style of, in the halachic style, I mean, of the tzedukim, the Sadducees. However, what then happens is that when the sectarians come into being in their group, they express opposition to the fact that the Chashmonaim have the Kohanim and the king, the temporal ruler, being one and the same. And that can be just seen very quickly in text 7, where, in text 8, where you have the notion that the, where's the council? It says 1,000 men will leave him. No, this is not the reference. Okay. So let me just tell you in any case that there is a text which says that the king and the ruler have to be separate. Now, what text 7 is about is the following. You notice that in the temple scroll from Qumran, the king has to be guarded all the time. This is probably a reaction to what happened to Yonatan. Now you're going to see, as we go along, that we can follow all of the Hasmonean rulers in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the thing comes into being in the time of Yonatan. So don't look for Judah. You're not going to find him. Now, it comes into being in the time of Yonatan. Yonatan is killed by being killed by a certain gentleman named Trypho, who was a Seleucid Syrian ruler who came to Akko. And he made a deal where they were going to have a meeting, you know, like you've ever seen in the movies where they have white flags and they come in the middle, the leaders have a meeting, and everybody's supposed to leave him alone. Well, anyhow, they had such a meeting. And at that meeting, his men surprised Yonatan and murdered him. And so if you look at the text that is number 7, you will see that the temple scroll says that when you have a king, he has to have a guard, and they have to always be, and it says in the last line, they shall guard him from every sinful thing. That does not mean that they have to make sure he does not eat a cookie with a triangle K. It means, or let alone go to some, hang out with some woman he shouldn't hang around with. Nothing like that. It means that they have to make sure that somebody doesn't kill him. That's what they mean. And that was the purpose of this law in number 7 after the experience of what happened to Yonatan. Now, furthermore, and here's where it is, right? The king is required in number 8 to come before the Kohen and inquire by the judgment of the Urim and Tumim. What this means, basically, it says about the high priest that his word, he shall go out, his word shall come in. The king has to follow the rulings of the priest. This is the protest against the king and the priest being one. Now, this group went out under the leadership of the teachers of righteousness, and they formed a community which we call the Dead Sea Sect. And if you look in text 9, you can see a basic principle of the group regarding the fact that they have to separate from the rest of everyone else and go to the desert. And of course, this is the notion that we know that eventually this group ended up at Qumran because they saw the need to separate from Jerusalem and go to Qumran. Now, when we talk, as in 10, about the teacher of righteousness, 10 is from what we call a pesha. Let me first explain quickly what that is. That's a commentary which understands certain parts of the 12 minor prophets, Isaiah and Tehillim, the Psalms, as referring to the actual history of the sectarians that have formed this new group. Now, the pesha text gives us a lot of historical information. And in this particular text, they interpret a biblical reference to refer to the priest, the teacher of righteousness, whom God chose to arise. This is the leader of the sectarians. And furthermore, there was apparently some type of inner opposition. So in 11, we hear about this thing called the House of Absalom, the men of the council, who kept silent when the teacher of righteousness was rebuked and didn't help him against the man of lies. The man of lies is generally believed to be a leader of the Prushim, the Pharisees. But when you get to 12, you see the Hasmonean thing come back. Its interpretation concerns the wicked priest who was called by the name of truth at the beginning. At the beginning, he looked like a good guy, and he turned out in the end not to be such a good guy. Now, you have to know that wicked priest, Kohen HaRasha, and the teacher of righteousness, Moreh HaTzedek, are two of the main historical figures in the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we never learn their names. However, about the wicked priest, there are many theories. The wicked priest must be any one of the Hashmonaim. So some people think, and we're going to sort of go in order now, that it's Yonatan. Some think that it's Shimon. Yonatan was killed in 143, and Shimon ruled from 143 to 138. And so they think it was Shimon. Shimon, by the way, was killed also. We'll mention that in a few minutes. And then other people think, coming after him from 138 to 104, you have Yochanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus, and some people even think Yanai, who is Alexander Janaeus, Yanai HaMelech for the Talmud, everybody here studies Daf Yomi, you've seen all these people, who ruled from as high priest and king from 103 to 76 BCE. However, in my opinion, this is Yonatan. My opinion, the wicked priest, is Yonatan because of the fact that the sect comes into being during the time of Yonatan and the hot controversy between those leaving the Beis HaMikdash and the person running the show as high priest and leader of the people would be Yonatan. But many scholars have different points of view about who that is. And in 14, we learn that there was some type of an attack which took place, right? And the wicked priest waited and somehow sought to put the teacher of righteousness to death, something which doesn't seem to have succeeded. But in any case, in 15, you get the sense again of the tremendous negative feelings that this person had, this Hasmonean, whoever the wicked priest was, for, in my opinion, Jonathan, for the leader of the teacher who had effectively rebelled against him. Now, as I mentioned, Yonatan was killed in Akko by this fellow Trypho, in 138. Now, what then happened, I'm sorry, in 143. And 143 BCE, Shimon takes over. Now, after Shimon took over, he eventually was killed. And I want to show you a passage here. Passage number 16 is a very difficult text. It occurs in two separate texts. And listen to this. It's an adaptation of Sefer Yoshua. Then Joshua finished praising and giving thanks in his psalms. He said, cursed be the man who builds the city, it's Jericho. He shall lay its foundation at the cost of his firstborn and set up its gates to the cost of his youngest. Let me tell you something funny. This text spells Joshua Yud Shin Vav Ayin. Two Orthodox rabbis, who obviously did not know that this is a quotation from Sefer Yoshua, published an article in the LA Times about 15 years ago, claiming that they had found the name of Jesus in the Dead Sea Scrolls. No one ever will publish a rebuttal. All these people read this in the LA Times. Anyhow, this text goes on and says certain things, but the point I want to emphasize is this. The text seems to discuss a situation in which some leader is going to rebuild Yericho and lose two sons in the process. There are two theories about what this refers to. One is what happened to Shimon, and then the other is what happened to the sons of the next main ruler after Shimon, Yochanan Hyrcanus. So let me tell you these two stories. Shimon himself was killed at an area place very near Yericho. What happened to Shimon was that, believe it or not, a relative of his actually killed Shimon and two of his sons, a cousin who was a captain of his guard. And the only one who survived that was Yochanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus, who from 138 on was the Hasmonean ruler. So he lost, they were killed there, the Shimon and the two sons. So some scholars think that that's what this text in number 16 is referring to. However, the next ruler afterwards, right, after he died, actually, was a certain Aristobulus. Aristobulus took sick and died in a year. But Aristobulus's brother was killed. So some think that this text refers to the death of the two sons, not of Shimon, but of the next Hasmonean, who is Yochanan Hyrcanus. Okay? Now, we're skipping from these guys to 17 down to Yanai. So remember, we now went through Alexander Danaus ruled from as high as king. I should have put a table on here. 138 to 104. In 104 to 103, you have Aristobulus for 1 year. The poor guy died. And after him comes Yanai from 103 to 76. Yanai was hated by everybody. So Josephus tells us an amazing story about Yanai. The amazing story is that the people hated him so much that they turned to the rulers of Syria, the same Seleucids we talked about. And a certain Demetrius was the ruler, and that's what the text mentions in 17. Demetrius, they call him king of Greece. It means the king of Seleucid Syria. And this Demetrius, they invited to come into their own city of Yerushalayim to make war against their own ruler. This is unbelievable. It's like some Israelis, let's say for the sake of argument, the Labor Party, ask Hezbollah to please attack Israel because they don't agree with Netanyahu. I mean, that's what you're talking about, right? So anyhow, these guys, right, come in, Demetrius and his men, and they're killing and raping and all this kind of stuff. And this, now, so far I'm telling you Josephus' side. And immediately these guys change sides, and that is to say the ones who invited them in, and help King Yanai to throw out this enemy. So they finally get thrown out, and they think that they're going to be forgiven. Guess what he does? He crucifies 800 of them while he's cavorting with his girlfriends on a divan, like a couch. And while that's going on, he makes the crucified guys watch the killing of their wives and children in front of their eyes. Now, he was a very nice guy. Now, this story is told in the scrolls with a new added detail. 17. Demetrius, king of Greece, who sought to enter Jerusalem with the council of the interpreters of false laws. Who are they? That's called Dorshei Chalakot. They are also called Ephraim. They are the Prushim, the Pharisees. According to the scrolls, the people who brought on the attack of Demetrius III Eukairos, 88 BCE, we know about this from Josephus, were the Pharisees. But God had not given Yerushalayim into the hand of the kings of Greece from Antiochus until the rise of the rulers of the Kitim. The Kitim are the Romans. It's a code word for the Romans. Really, Kition is in Cyprus, but it means people are going to come from the sea. And what's this business about Antiochus? There are two possibilities. Antiochus III in 198 BCE, he conquered Eretz Yisrael. Or maybe they mean Antiochus IV, the one from Hanukkah, if you think he really did conquer Eretz Yisrael. So you'll have to decide. If you think Antiochus really conquered Eretz Yisrael, even though he was eventually thrown out, it could mean that from the time of Antiochus IV, when he conquered Eretz Yisrael, until the Romans came, which is 63 BCE, the writers living after that, no one ever conquered Eretz Yisrael. However, you could also think it's Antiochus III who conquered Eretz Yisrael in 198 and was, by the way, Antiochus III is the one who took it away from the previous period in which it was ruled by the Egyptian Ptolemies, who were the Egyptian successors of Alexander. Because, you know, it was seesawing back and forth, right, for 100 years of control between Egypt and Syria. One way or another, look at this text. Demetrius sought to, with the council of the interpreted force. So what we learn from the scroll is that it was the Prushim, the Pharisees, who did this. Now, look what happened. Demetrius made war against the Lion of Wrath. Who's the Lion of Wrath? The Lion of Wrath, this is a pesher in the book of Nahum, by the way. It's a commentary on Nahum, which tells us all these details. The Lion of Wrath is Alexander Yanai, known as Yanai HaMelech and Shas. Anyhow, by the way, there's a Gemara where it says, who Yochanan, who Yanai. It doesn't mean Yochanan and Yanai the same person. Some people misunderstand it. It means they both went down the path that's described about Yochanan going gadol in Brachot, that it says there, Shimesh kechoin gadol arba'im shana b'chuna gadol, Shimesh arba'im shana 40 years, u'lesof nasat tuki, he became a Sadducee in the end. In other words, both of them are understood to have started out righteous and then deteriorated into Sadducee in heretical ways. So that's both of them. It doesn't mean it's the same person. They're not the same person. They're two different people who ruled at different times. Anyhow, but here's something really amazing. Yet again, the interpreter's false laws in that he hanged men alive, which was never done in Israel before. Because what did this guy do? We know from Josephus. He crucified all of these, we now know from the scroll, Pharisees, who had brought in this enemy army. Okay, now we're almost at the end of the whole period of the Chashmonaim. You've seen every single one is reflected somehow in the scrolls. Now we get to something amazing. There is this poetic text, which is a prayer for Yanai, which was found in the scrolls. Now you can say, I understand, Yanai was a bad guy. They couldn't stand him. Look what they just described that he did. He killed all these people alive. What are they praying for his welfare? So some scholars feel that this prayer might have been from the beginning of his rule, before he turned out to be so bad. Holy One, watch over, or arise, O Holy One, on behalf of, I'll tell you a little secret. We have no idea what these words mean. The first word is Ur, Ayin Vav Resh. And then it says Kodesh. And if anybody could tell me what Ur Kodesh means, poor holiness, I don't know what Ace means. Right? So I don't know what it means. Doesn't matter. And Ur meaning to look out for. Okay. So we don't know what it means. King Jonathan. Now, Yanai is a nickname for Yonatan. Yanai is like they say today, Yoni. That's what Yanai is. On Jonathan and all the congregation of your people, Israel, who are in four corners of heaven, may peace be upon all of them and upon your kingdom. May your name be blessed. Some suggest that this is like Tfilah L'Shalom Hamdina. It's like a blessing for the country, right? Or the prayer for the Tsar. I knew a man who was saved in the Russian army by the prayer for the Tsar and his sitter. What happened was that he found out that his brother died, and he was davening. And you know, in World War I, he was davening, and some guy came up, some officer, and started yelling at him or something like that. So he smashed the guy. The guy I know was about 8 feet tall. Not really, but I mean, way over 6 feet, much taller than me. Smashed this officer, and the officer was like practically unconscious. So they court-martialed him. So he says, look what the man did. He comes up to me. He's disturbing me while I'm praying for the Tsar. He opens, shows him the sitter. He says, I was praying for the Tsar. And look, this man is beating me up. What's going on here? So he got off. Right? Because he had the prayer for the Tsar and his prayer and his sitter. But the point is that some say that this is like that. I don't know. But it shows you that there at some point they regarded Yanai as a good guy. Okay. Now, what I want to therefore point out here is that if you look down the whole thing, you've gotten almost all the Chashmonaim. But after Yanai, who came next? So Yanai was succeeded by his wife, Shlom Tzion HaMalkah. Everybody's been on her street. Now, here's the story about Shlom Tzion HaMalkah. Her name comes in a passage, number 18, where there's zero context. We have no idea what it means. But it's so important for the following reason. The Gemara mentions Shlom Tzion. Josephus calls her Salome Alexandra. The Gemara calls her, depending on what text you're looking at, either Shel Tzion, Shin Lamed, Tzadi Yud Vav Nun, or Shlotzion. There's no mem. And this text gives us the full spelling of her name, which was not known. Now, many people guessed, like the people who made the street name, that it was Shlom Tzion. And the final one is Hyrcanus the king. This is not Yochanan Hyrcanus. This is Hyrcanus II, who's mentioned also in a passage from the scrolls with no context. But Hyrcanus was the ruler after, you will remember, that Yanai died in 76. And we're going to finish in about a minute here and have some questions. Yanai died in 76, and he knew they hated him. So he told his wife, according to Josephus, the only way that you're going to be able to stay ruling is if you disgrace me in public. Drag my body through the streets and disgrace me. So, of course, you know Shlom Tzion HaMalkah was either the sister or close relative, right, of one of the main leaders, Shimon ben Shetach, of the rabbis. And they said, no, you don't do this. Doesn't matter, right? We don't drag some guy through the street and disgrace his body. It's not the Jewish way. So they gave him a state funeral. Everybody got the point. And they gave him the state funeral, and that was the end of it, and she became the queen. Now, she could not make a succession plan that would work. And her two sons, when she died in 67 BCE, her two sons, Aristobulus, we call him two, and Hyrcanus, we call him two, fought with one another. And both appealed to the Romans to come in, and the Romans already were going to conquer Eretz Yisrael anyhow for bigger political reasons. And in 63 BCE, Pompey, the Roman general, conquered Eretz Yisrael. He then did this clever move of choosing the weaker. He chose Hyrcanus II to be the ruler and high priest, and Hyrcanus II was basically run by a certain Antipater, who was the father of Herod, who laid the course for the eventual Roman appointment of Herod as a king. So the Hasmonean era ends in 63 with the Roman takeover, and these last names on the bottom, Hyrcanus, is that high priest that they appointed. We don't have time for it here. There were still some attempts by the Hashmonaim to regain power again. They didn't really succeed. And in the end, of course, Judaism entered the period of Roman domination that eventually, unfortunately, led away from the happy Hanukkah celebration that caused us to talk about the Hashmonaim to the not-so-happy events of the Roman destruction. But we'll close here and open up for questions. And I guess people are free to take more food if they want it, if anybody wants to. Yes, please. It's one little area of hundreds and hundreds of things where the Dead Sea Scrolls inform us about stuff we didn't know. Just chosen because it's Hanukkah.
But we really didn't know much of
the whole. A lot of the things that are in here we didn't know. Some of them we did know because Josephus gives us a very detailed discussion of these.
We attribute the writings to the sect.
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not sure that every writing I quoted to you was actually written by the Dead Sea sectarians. I'm sure that they were all in their library. That doesn't mean that they composed all those writings. That's a whole issue in Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls sect, for example, a third of the material is Bible. They didn't write the Bible. They gathered it into their library. So certain things here belong to the library. They don't necessarily mean that the people, the sectarians that were formed in the aftermath of Yonatan's takeover of the rule, that doesn't mean that they authored every text. Okay, yes, please.
Yes.
I guess we're getting all the ladies first over here because they're all that end.
The
Prushim, we can only follow.
Did they have mixed feelings about it?
Well, we know that the Prushim had mixed feelings because of the famous episode that Josephus tells regarding Yochanan and Hyrcanus, and that the Gemara tells regarding Yanai, and it doesn't make a difference to us which one it is, where there was some kind of a big dinner, and somebody told Eliezer ben Poera, which I'm not sure if that's going to be a real name because Poer is a negative word. Right, it's not a nice name, so I can't believe anybody really had that name. But it means that he was a bad guy. So anyhow, Eliezer ben Poera told the king to tell the Prushim to take a loyalty oath. Now the Prushim wouldn't take oaths except for judicial oaths, so therefore they refused. And this resulted in the killing of a lot of Prushim. Now what this indicates is that the Prushim also had serious objections to certain things about the way the Hashmonaim were at least operating. Now, the other side of it is that we know in the Gemara that there's a different complaint about the Hashmonaim, which is the complaint that the Hashmonaim might not have been legitimate priests, not that they were not legitimate kings, because of the claim that their mother might have actually been taken into captivity and raped. And interestingly enough, the Gemara says it's not even true. But nonetheless, it reflected a kind of opposition to the Hashmonaim as Kohanim Gedolim, because they're not the legitimate group of Tzdukim of the Bnei Tzadok who are supposed to be the Kohanim. And of course, in the latter part of the Second Temple period, beginning with Herod and the Romans, they put back in Sadducee Bnei Tzadok high priests, which were considered more legitimate. Okay. Yes, sir.
You mentioned there were some halachic differences between the Tzdukim and regarding temples.
All kinds of things. Temple's purity. Well, let me give you the famous example because I have the props right here. Famous example is the Din of Nitzok. So, the Din of Nitzok says the following. It's in the Mishnah. And it says, it's in the group where you have the Mishnah about Prushim and Stukim and Yadayim, a whole bunch of differences. If I'm pouring this water down here, you see, this is an impure vessel. This is a pure vessel. And I'm going like this. According to the Prushim, the Tuma, the impurity, can only go in the direction the liquid went. It can't go backwards. According to the Tzdukim, it can go backwards. This is a big fight that took place in the Mishnah. Now, this halachic disagreement. And the MMT document, which calls it Mutzakot, says that they have to be done according to the way that Tzdukim say. Because they say it's one one liquid. And therefore, the tumor, the impurity, can actually go back up. Now, actually, you should know that in Yoredeya, according to laws of Kashrut, non-kosher, in quotes, can go up against the flow. But purity and impurity, according to the regular halacha of the Prushim and the rabbis, only goes down with the flow. Okay? But the other way, if you're pouring, milk, hot milk into soup, and the upper pot is dairy, the upper pot becomes non-kosher if it's being poured into a chicken soup, and if it's a continuous flow, right, then it does go back. In kashrut, it goes back. But in purity and impurity, it doesn't go back. And according to these guys, it did go back. That's one example. I could give you other examples having to do, for example, leaving over. How do you understand when it says that something could be left over until the next day? Certain sacrifices, shlamim sacrifices, were left over an extra day. Apparently, the prushim, you know, is what it says in the Mishnah, which some people say every morning, shtei yamim v'lai lechad, which means day, night, day. Not 2 days and a night. Shayim v'lai l'chad means day, night, day. So actually, these guys thought it was only day, one night. So they disallowed the leaving of sacrifices around. And other such types of things that they thought were being done wrong. Now, of course, these to outsiders sound like very important, unimportant things. But of course, to somebody who understands that this is understood to be the word of God and somebody's violating it, you can understand how it could be very much a big deal. And I think we also have to remember that one of the problems of these sectarian groups in Judaism is, I mean, you know, we think today that we have a lot of intolerance, but actually it's not true, right? They had much more intolerance in those days because everybody was really, this was really a war over who was going to rule over the temple, etc. And the levels of intolerance were a lot greater than what we're used to. So some of these differences where, you know, later on they might just be Rabbi X and Rabbi Y, or today could be Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Hasidim and other people. We're sort of used to this, but they were not quite so used to it. And these became major, major issues of disagreement. Okay, yep, Jay.
Do you have a theory on how a copy of the Sadakite fragment wound up in the
Kairos? Okay, he wants to know how a text written that's found in the Dead Sea Scrolls could end up in the Cairo Geniza, medieval manuscript. These were not ancient, these were medieval manuscripts. So first of all, this is not the only text. There are other texts like Ben Sira, which was found in the Cairo Geniza and is an ancient text, a few others. Now, we have several possibilities. Possibility number one, we know about medieval discoveries of ancient manuscripts. Possibility number two, survival of underground tradition, because certain Sadducee and sectarian traditions survive from Second Temple times and they come out in Karaism in the Middle Ages. These are the two possibilities, either discovery of texts or underground sources of people who followed sectarian ways that just weren't so visible. And they passed on texts, and eventually these texts found their way into a collection like the Cairo Geniza. But these are not really answers. These are possibilities. And if somebody would talk like he knows, he's kidding himself. We really can't be so certain about that, about how it really happened. Other questions? Karaites follow some of these. There's a guy who spends his life studying Karaite halakha. They study, but these sacrificial things are irrelevant. But they have some Karaite laws are similar to the laws of the sect. Yes, sir.
The Hashmonean kings themselves. Sided with the Sadducees somehow. Like Yochanan and Yannai.
Yeah.
So why did they invite them back or something like that?
Why did they fight back?
Why did they invite the sect back to Yerushalayim?
Oh, so here's the problem. The problem is that the sectarians, this is a good point, the sectarians ended up, as the Hasmoneans became more and more Hellenized, they also more and more went back to Tztuki-type halakha. And the Tztukim became the Kohanim Gedolim. So the question is, why did they not get them somehow enough to come back and rejoin them? Because by that time, the sectarians developed all kinds of other things that caused them to hate the Hashmonaim, and to be completely opposed to all kinds of other things about their rule that are beyond our session right now, like the making of war against people just to get money, and all kinds of things that they disagreed with of what was going on. And the R group became a group of separatist, pietist sectarians who had exited the kind of mainstream to a kind of almost separatist life. So all of this kind of thing had happened, and I guess on some level it wasn't really reversible, right, by that time. Yeah.
Essentially, there are two different types of stukim.
I maintain that there are two types of Tzedukim, in a certain sense, right? That there are these very Hellenized guys who were mentioned by Josephus, and they're becoming more and more Hellenized, and then there are these real pietists. And I don't think that this is so hard to understand, because if you look at Josephus's discussion of these sectarian groups, we know he talks about the rebels against Rome. He calls them the fourth philosopher. We know there were at least six groups in this thing. And so all these six are, you know, considered as if they're one. We're probably getting the signal here that we're going to end soon, but yeah.
So who are the Tzedukim in the Olam Mishnayos, the ones who kept Shavuos
on Sunday? So in the rabbinic texts, you seem to be talking about the religious type Tzedukim. Why? They stand for their principles of halakha. So when you get a story, let's jump from the Mishnah now for a moment to the Gemara. You get a story that there was a Tzedukim in the neighborhood of so-and-so, and this Tzedukim didn't accept the Eruv. What does it mean? He did not accept that you could use this technique to avoid the law against carrying on Shabbat. So he was a right-wing fanatic, not the left-wing guy. And he thought that you had to not follow these various laws that the Prushim had to get around things. Right? So these, because by this time, the sectarians, we have to understand one thing, basic principle. From the day they started, let's say in 150 or so BCE, they became more and more radicalized. And they developed a sectarian mentality in which you start to hate everybody else. And then it's very easy to explain why everybody else is no good. You see, if you're going to be different from everybody else, you can think everybody else is a good person. It's just that they don't do it the way I do. I have my own reasons. Well, you can hate them. And when you get in these conflicts, what happens is they become more and more hating them. In fact, I was once giving a lecture somewhere, and a Protestant minister was trying to disagree with my idea that they weren't proto-Christians. So I read him a text, and the text, it says that you should hate all the outsiders. And I just said, if you want this, you can have it. So the whole audience applauded. The poor guy felt a little dumb. There were 700 people there. The whole audience applauded. But the bottom line is they actually preach hatred of outsiders. And that's how they went down that road of sectarianism. So thank you very much. And